everybody. Welcome back to Crime Scene Queens. I'm Shelly, your legal beagle and your resident court cat.
And I'm Laura, your friendly neighborhood field mouse and resident CSI.
And today we actually have a very special guest. We are actually going to interview a gentleman whose nickname is Tad. And some of you may know who he is and some of you may not, but you're definitely going to learn all about him. And I'm very, very, very excited that he's on our show today. So, Tad, can you do me a favor and just kind of say hi and introduce yourself?
Sure. So, hi, Shelly and Laura. I'm Tad Tobias. And my Tad is my nickname, but my real nickname for true crime purposes is the Nobody Guy, because I specialize in consulting and working on nobody murder cases.
Exactly. And nobody doesn't mean nobody. It's nobody. It's yes. A lack of the corpus
lecti.
Yes.
For you
yes.
Latin fans.
For the Latin fans.
Which is kind of funny to be on a forensics podcast when you don't have a body, because, of course, that's one of the problems is you don't have a lot yes. of the forensic stuff you usually have when you don't have a body. Mm-hmm. So that's it. That's correct. The show. It's
there
2 minutes.
Go.
We're
it's
all done.
Over, and good luck with your next show.
Yes, you can use Mr. Google to find out who Tad is. Thank you, everybody.
Exactly. We'll see you next week.
Well, first of all, I have to say, okay, Tad, you are an attorney. You were AUSA. And so, you know, we do have a schedule. And I have to say, thank you so much for being on time, because in the legal field, we have ish time. And you know, you were actually like very punctual. In fact, you were a minute early. So I really appreciate that.
Yes.
Round of applause.
I try to be on time, and I'm no longer an AUSA. I have a completely different job that I don't talk about on the podcast. But I was a prosecutor in D.C. for 12 years. And most of that time mm-hmm. I did homicides, about the last 10.
Yeah, your resume is impressive, you know, and as you were like mentioning earlier, we are taught as little baby duckling CSIs that when you are having a death investigation, regardless of the nature of that investigation, the biggest and most important piece of evidence is the body. So mm-hmm. in your experience, kind of starting from beginning to where you are now, like take me on that journey of how you became the expert in these cases that didn't have the body. I'm so curious as to how that came into your expertise.
So when I was in law school, I was very interested in becoming a prosecutor. I wanted to be an FBI agent, but I have really poor eyesight, so I couldn't pass the FBI eyesight test. So I thought, well, what's like an FBI agent? And a prosecutor is kind of like that. You can use a law degree. So I went to law school. When I came out, I interviewed at a bunch of prosecution places, but I had a professor who's actually the prosecutor for John Gotti and the successful mm-hmm. prosecution of John Gotti, a guy named John Gleason, who went on to become a judge in the Eastern District of New York. And I just like worshiped this guy and took a class from him. And he said, oh, you want to become a federal prosecutor. And to do that, you got to go to a law firm, got to go to a big law firm. So I did that. Wasn't crazy about my time at a law firm, but became ultimately a prosecutor in D.C., which is a great place to be a prosecutor because D.C. doesn't have a district attorney. So all of the crimes in D.C., for the most part, from shoplifting up to murder, are actually prosecuted by the federal prosecutor. It's the largest U.S. attorney's office in the country. So I spent most of my career really what most people think of as a DA. I was a homicide prosecutor, violent crime prosecutor. And I did some stuff in federal court, but it never really interested me. In fact, the joke was when someone would come into my office, like with a drug case or a public corruption case, I would always ask, is there a dead body or a person in the case? And they'd say no. And I would say, well, then I don't give a shit, because that's the only thing I care about is doing homicides. So,
right. So I have to cut you off real quick because I do have to ask you just a real quick question. So do you happen, this is something that another attorney has always says to me. Do you happen to know the difference between a federal judge and God?
I don't think there is any difference.
Yeah. God is not the federal right, judge.
Exactly. Yeah. Well,
yes. Yes. Federal court is definitely different.
Career,
is this a lawyer joke?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I like, you guys are hilarious joke. With your lawyer jokes.
That's okay. I'm learning something new about federal judges.
So in D.C., you have the local court, which is called D.C. Superior Court. And those judges are local court judges, but they're actually presidentially appointed, but they're not federal judges. So every judge in Superior Court, of course, ultimately wants to try and get on the district court. But they also think that they're like federal judges because they're paid like federal judges and they have 15-year tenures and you know, they're appointed by the president. But so it can, we have a very good bench in D.C., to be fair, because it is a very high quality. But they all want to go on to district court. So when I became a prosecutor, I tried very quickly to try to get to the homicide section because that's what I was interested in. And probably about two or three years in, I started doing homicides and I did that the rest of my career. I was a supervisor a couple times, but I always kind of kept my hand in it. And then one day a colleague of mine came to me because he was transferring a section and I was coming into a new section. And he said, hey, I have this missing persons case, but I really think it's a homicide. And I was very excited because I thought like, okay, murder's the ultimate crime, but a no body murder is like the ultimate murder. So this is like the peak of the peak. And then I ended up working on this case, trying this case, successfully prosecuting this case, because as I tell people, if I lost the fucking case, I never would have done anything with bodies again.
Right.
Like, yeah, no, I'm done. I'm a crack cocaine prosecution expert now.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, yeah. So that's how I became interested.
Yeah. That's amazing. I totally relate. All right, let's just put it shortly. I went from a very wealthy agency where we had literally every crime scene tool available to a different agency where there was like holes in my crime scene van and I didn't have a measurement wheel because the first city I had about four homicides a year and the second city I had two homicides a week. So I understand your inner drive to want to do something bigger.
And in DC, I learned when I started researching it, I thought, oh my God, DC, homicide capital of the nation at one point. We had 486 homicides 1 year. We regularly had over 300 a year for a city of, at the time, was only about 500,000 people. But they had only had one other successful nobody case. So that was what also kind of piqued my interest was, hey, we haven't had that many cases. We had one. How do you actually prosecute this case? So I started looking nationally. A friend of mine in the office who had investigated a nobody case but hadn't prosecuted gave me a list of like 50 or 60 cases a law clerk had found. So I just started researching the cases, and because I am super, super anal, and I've written down every mile I've ever run since seventh grade.
You're kidding me.
No, in fact, the desk I'm sitting at, no one at home can see this, but I'm showing you ladies.
Oh, my goodness.
These are my running logs that record all the miles since seventh grade.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
You should like laminate them right or here. Something, or it's like,
I know. I'm like, what happens if the house burns down? I won't have them anymore.
Well, then
those
that's miles
the person you grab.
Yeah, those miles would be gone. Clearly, you never ran them.
No,
they disappear now.
No, you need to put them in a trapper. No, you need to put them in a trapper keeper, and then if there's a fire, then you grab that
or
trapper
keeper. Throw them in the fireproof safe or something. But so anyway, so I started recording every case I could find. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing, you know, my case and investigating it, and I decided at the time, because I worked, you know, for the Department of Justice, I didn't want to get approval for a website. So I just did it anonymously and posted it on the interwebs. And I didn't use my name. I just said the nobody guy. So that was how the nickname came up. And then when I left the U.S. Attorney's office, I said, oh, I can like come out of the shadows or come out of the closet, so to speak.
Come out of the no body closet.
The no body closet where I was actually storing a body, and you can see the closets behind me. There's like six bodies.
Yes.
So that was when then I started really doing it and really counting, and eventually wrote a book that came out in 2014. But I'm actually working on the second edition, so that's going to come out hopefully sometime next year. Yeah. So I'm very excited about that. They said, you sold enough books, which I think was like five. And we'll do a second edition.
That's great. And you can get 20% off if you shop now.
Exactly. Or if you go to the remainder's bin about 6 months from now, you can get it like for 20 cents.
Okay. So here's my story about your book. I was going to buy it to read it, but I didn't realize when I saw that you had authored a book that it was a textbook.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
It's like $70. To be fair, and when they told me the price, I was like,
"It's $150."
No, get the paper. When I tried to look to buy it, I'll send you a copy because you're having me on my podcast.
I will read it.
Oh, I'm so
excited!
And
I'll charge you $68 because we're friends. Mm. So it's really
fantastic. Well, I am a professor, so I can probably get them to send me a desk copy if I wanted to be sneaky about it.
I'm thinking about using this for my entire class. Not.
That's exactly right. Wow. But actually, it probably wouldn't. I mean, depending on what you have in there, my class is Intro to Crime Scene Investigation, so it would be an interesting module to like propose to the university. But the point of having no body, unless you're living where I am, where we probably have an entire swamp full of bodies in the Everglades, like very Dexter. It's Jimmy Hoffa that's somewhere in Giants Stadium. It's not actually that easy to get rid of a body, in my opinion. And that includes like disarticulating them, burning them. Like everybody on TV makes it seem like getting rid of a body is super easy. Let me tell you, as a previous forensic anthropology student who had to dismember and disarticulate many bodies, it is not so easy to do that.
No, it's a lot of effort. Exactly right, Laura. It is not easy. I mean, if you're talking about 150 to 200 pounds of flesh, bones, teeth, all of hair, all of that, it really is difficult because it takes a long time for a body to decompose, even in Florida, very hot and humid climate.
Even in Florida,
it can take a long time. It's sort of physically hard, right? I got to like saw
it's it athletic.
Yes.
Even and with maceration.
Yeah. I always say if you've ever been, as I know you both have, to a medical examiner's office, you see the what they used to call orderlies. I don't think they call them anymore. But the people who basically work with the bodies, not the forensic pathologists, but their arms are like they're not like mine. They're like my thigh they have for forearms from like sawing and everything. It's crazy.
Yes. Yeah.
So it is very hard. And as a result, though, for, you know, folks like you all, you leave a lot behind, right? You got Foucault's principle of transference. You're going to, it's almost impossible to completely clean up. And that's what leaves behind for the forensic crime scene analyst. You know, there's going to be hair, blood, clothing traces,
teeth,
other things, liquids left behind. It is really difficult. And people think, oh, I can burn a body on like my barbecue. Oh yeah. Does your barbecue go to 1400 Fahrenheit? Cause I don't think so.
Yeah. Actually, I was teaching a course pretty recently. The last day of the course, we do a mock trial. So I have them bring in their reports and such. And we were talking about this case where this guy had killed his girlfriend and dismembered her. And was like getting rid of her different parts and pieces of her throughout, you know, a week or so. But the torso, he was just like, I'm done. I'm just done. This is so exhausting. What? You know, he's like trying to cut it and everything. And he literally just left it on the stairs in between like apartments and was like, yep, I'm getting caught. So here we are.
Exactly. No, and that's why, you know, bodies of water are important because you can weigh it down and you don't necessarily have to cut it up as much.
But you can, they turn to soap sometimes.
Oh,
right?
That was episode 2 for you. I skipped episode 2 because I was like, I'm going to the courtroom one because the soap one sounds good though. I'm going to come back and catch that one.
It's about Adipus here.
Yes.
Yeah, because I have actually, in Florida, I've had quite a few Adipocere cases. But yeah, you know, to your point, I think the reason why the Everglades is just so insanely unique is not only are they dense with brush and plant growth, they are also rich with wildlife. So it's a lot easier than it would be in other, I mean, as you both probably know, and our audience probably can extrapolate, the Everglades is such a unique ecosystem that it's literally the only one of its kind. So the ability to hide a body in all of that plant life mixed in with the swamp, and then you also have the predators on top of it, and some of those alligators do consume bone. So we are a bit unique here.
Yeah, and the predators will carry it away as well, too, which makes it more difficult. You may think, oh, I found the scene. I found parts of the body, but I don't have the whole thing because it's been carried away. Or that's I found the carried away piece, you know, a toe, a foot, or a hand, but that's all I have. I don't have anything else. Yeah, it's a real challenge in Florida.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, speaking to like our discussion about how difficult it is to disarticulate, since Shelley talked about like this torso that was just left in the staircase, in a situation where there was no criminal violation, so there's not that anxiety and that adrenaline of am I going to get caught? As a student in a completely legal mm-hmm. environment working on a body donation, it takes over a month to remove soft tissue, to disarticulate, to put in the maceration pots, to boil, to then remove, yep. empty, strip, boil. It takes over a month to get a human body to bone without the natural processes of decomposition. There are some bits of research that show that you can have
the spices you add and the
crock pot.
Yeah.
Add a little bit of cinnamon for the aromatic. Well, you know what's funny about you saying that is the odor is particular for maceration. So in order to help degrease the bone, we do put something the equivalent, not this exact thing, but the equivalent of Goo Gone. So it's like this citrus odor mixed with boiling people. You're welcome, guys, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody's welcome.
Everyone, it's dinner time when you're listening to
this. It's dinner time. Yeah, without the stress of having to worry about getting caught, it takes forever.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, though, because that's what actually points to a lot of our suspects, right? Because if I'm a burglar and I break into someone's house and the homeowner is home and I'm like, oh, shit, the homeowner's home. So I take my pistol and I shoot and kill him. I'm not going to say, hey, I think I'll hang out and cut them up and get rid of the body so no one will ever know. Yeah. No, they're going to get the fuck out of the house. So your suspect, typically in a no-body murder case, 54% of the time, is a domestic person. It's the ex-boyfriend or the husband. And so when you don't have a body, because they're the only ones who can take the time, typically in a controlled scenario inside a house, to get rid of a body, right? Because it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of time. So when you have a body that's missing and you suspect murder, it does help generate, well, who would be my pool of suspects who could do this? A burglar is not going to do it, but a husband might, because a husband can spend 2 days inside of a house and can, you know, cut up the body, tote it out, can clean it up in the bathtub and all that. And that's why you do see so many no-body murder cases are domestic, because it's just those two people in the house.
I took the time to pose the question to my community of crime scene investigators, and I said, hey, how many of you have had a homicide where there was no body, and tell me about it? And Tad, I was wondering if you had this experience, like subsequently, a lot of them wrote back and said, well, we have, but sometime later, eventually the body was found.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that ever happened to you with any of the things that you've prosecuted where like there was no body and then like sometime after it's gone through the court system, then it presented itself.
Yes. I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not uncommon, if that makes sense.
Right.
So what you often find is in all the cases, like in my book, for example, I think we're up to, I always forget, it's like 540 cases right now. No, I'm sorry. It's like 570 cases. All of those cases are trials. And they went to trial without a body. But often when the person is convicted, typically it's a guy, he'll say, hey, after he's convicted and oh, shit, I'm facing the death penalty or life without parole. Although the death penalty is somewhat uncommon in a no-body murder case. But say he's facing life without parole. And he says, hey, if I tell you where the body is, will you knock it down to, you know, life with possibility of parole?
Yeah.
Happens all the time. Happens also because many no-body murderers are narcissistic, are all about control because they're domestic abusers.
Right.
Not, it's a completely common pattern. And so they'll say, I'll take you to where the body is. So one of the things I did after I wrote the first book is I had my older daughter go through the book and do a spreadsheet of where bodies were found or disposed of in cases that we knew where that happened. And I'm still paying for the therapy bills from her having to do this. And that's fine. That's good. It got me what I wanted, which was a spreadsheet of all these cases. And here's where the bodies were disposed of. And sometimes it was because they found the body afterwards. Sometimes it was because the defendant admitted it or there was a strong suspicion what had happened. And so you could kind of tell, well, what's the most common? Just dumping is very common. body of water is very common, but dumpster is extremely common, particularly in an area like Washington,
dumpster,
where I live, because it's easy, right? You put it in a black trash bag and you throw it in a dumpster. Nobody looks at what's inside a dumpster.
Right.
So, but you, it's not uncommon for people to use the body as a bargaining chip to help themselves down the road.
I hear you.
Yeah,
that makes
sense. They plead guilty because they want the lighter sentence, or they want to escape potentially the death penalty.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, why wouldn't you say, okay, I'll tell you where it is now? And there's a famous case in Maryland involving a guy who killed his next door neighbor, who was a little girl. It was a somewhat rare stranger on stranger. And years later, for no benefit, he ended up telling the prosecutor where the body was, and they took him to the location and they dug him up, and it wasn't that far from his house, which is the other thing you see. Typically, when they do find the body, it's in a location familiar to the defendant, right? Because as you've both noted, it takes a long time to get rid of a body. So I'm not going to get rid of a body in a completely strange place where all of a sudden I'm digging a big ass grave. And I'm about to put the body in, and some farmer shows up with a shotgun saying, "What the hell are you doing, boy, on my property?"
Yeah.
It's like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
So you often find they're going to locations known to them, which, of course, is important from a forensic and an investigative standpoint of saying, if I'm this defendant, where would I go to get rid of a body?
Exactly.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that story you just told is strikingly similar to, like, the Lovely Bones, kind of, like, some random neighbor.
Absolutely.
Kidnapping a little girl, that's never a great scenario.
He'd actually killed two girls, one of whom the body they found, and then the second one they didn't find until ultimately years later. Oh, and you want to hear one more fun fact?
Yeah. Yes.
Of course.
The prosecutor on that case is now one of the attorneys for Donald Trump. This guy named Jim Trustee was a great prosecutor. Yeah, so fun. So fun tie-in to our modern times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey.
Oh, I like it.
Look at that. That's impressive. I mean, I'm sure he's getting a hefty paycheck now. So good for him.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure he'd like himself to disappear now. He's like, could someone just fucking kill me now with this guy as a client?
he certainly is a busy boy.
Yeah.
But you know what I've been circling back to in my mind? Because I've not had many death investigations where there wasn't a body. I can think of one in particular, but I was not the lead investigator. I was a supportive role in crime scene unit. So when I was first hearing about this with you and your specialty, my first thought went straight to, like, what I would do on a crime scene like that and how I would collect evidence like that and what it would take for a prosecutor like yourself to have what you needed to do things. Like, for example, the call that I have a recollection of in my career is there was a constant state of discord between two neighbors. Eventually, it came to a head. There was constant threats of violence. One guy disappears. The other guy is seen driving his truck down the road with garbage bag in body shape in the bed of the truck. Later, through very good forensic work, like one or two teeny drops of blood were found in the bed of that truck. We saw him driving towards a large garbage, where they bring your garbage, the
landfill.
The landfill. Thank you. Yep. To a landfill. Yeah. So we brought dogs out there. We did everything we could, but we never recovered the neighbor. But that is an example of something that did go through, but I left before I found out the end result of that. So, like, what kinds of evidence do you guys need when you're doing this? Like, what do you look for?
For me, I would say, like, circumstantial evidence is what you've got, and turning that into direct evidence.
Yes.
If there's any possibility.
And direct evidence can be, you know, cell phone information, CCTV. But one of the things
the ping is how we know that.
Yes. Where they are.
That's how we knew he was going to the dump.
Yep. One of the things I talk about in the book and when I do the training for investigators is, and this is, I think, particularly important for forensic investigators who are used to saying, what's here? What can I find that's here? But you also have to think about, well, what's not here?
What's
what am
not
I not
here?
Finding?
No, we're,
I'm
yes.
not finding
the void.
I'm not finding her
Correct.
Phone. I'm not finding her purse. I'm not finding certain things that I would expect to find, you know, in a house where, okay, the person's missing, but you know, if they're actually, if someone killed them and got rid of those things, am I finding, if I found some evidence of some trauma happening in the house, am I finding implements that are consistent with that, or am I not finding them? If you're looking at a knife and a cutting block, are all the knives there, or is there a missing knife? Mm-hmm. So those are the types of mm-hmm. things we talk about. There's a very well-known case I lecture on where a woman goes missing and the guy tells the family, hey, she went on vacation. So the family comes over to the house and is looking around. And this is, you know, perfect for women forensic investigators, which we have so many of them. And they start looking through the women's stuff. And what they realize is, yes, there's a bag packed. It's missing. Yes, there's clothing missing. But there were no bras packed. And immediately, What does that tell you? A dude packed her fake ass bag and pretended that she went on vacation because he's like, blouse.
That's right.
Pants. Underwear, didn't pack a bra. And no so bras, ultimately they went to the police and told them and said, look, she would never go on a trip without packing bras. And we can see because her drawers stuffed with them, all of her bras are here. So that's the type of stuff of making a conclusion from something that's there
I love that.
Not there. And that's really critical to tell forensic folks, you're not just looking for what's there. Think about what's missing that may have been used and use the family to say, what is not here? Oh, yeah, his chainsaw is missing. Oh, well, shit, that's a good fact. If I find blood in the garage and the chainsaw is missing. So those types of things talk about, you know, what might be missing from a scene. Not you're not only there to collect what's there, but to think about what should be there, but is not.
I love that story. Exactly. That like about the bras. When I was in college, one thing that kind of sticks out in my forensic psychology class is my professor was trying to demonstrate why it's important to have that diverse perspective of things. And there's a scene in Silence of the Lambs where Clarice Starling is asked to go inside the governor's daughter's room or another missing girl. I don't remember which one it is. And they say, well, you can go in there, but there's no point. It's been combed over and over and over again. And she picks up a jewelry box and instinctively pulls the bottom out of it or pulls the mirror out of it because, like, that's where, like, the girl, like, she was thinking like a woman. Like, and then she found all of those photographs.
And it is
just
really
a man
important.
Would never think. Yep. Yeah.
And I talk about that. Actually, I've been working on writing the second book, and I talk about when you are conducting any type of murder investigation, particularly a missing person that you think is a murder, you have to have a diverse team because you have to have people of different ages and different genders. Because if you're talking about social media and things like that, all of us are of a certain age that, you know, we probably use Facebook because we're losers. And our kids say, I know you all probably have much younger kids than I do, but my kids who are 25 and 22 are like, Dad, nobody uses Facebook. You're pathetic.
My son's older than your kids.
So we use TikTok and we use Insta and used to be Snapchat, not so much anymore. But you need to have that diversity of experience. It can't be old white male detectives. Because they never would have picked up on, oh, all of her bras are here. They would have been like, oh, that's a drawer of her bras. Gross. Don't want to touch that. Like, creepy.
Yeah.
And that is a really important point.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually love that point because, like, whenever you say these things, you're triggering all these, like, perspectives for me. Because in that second city that I worked for with that high volume of homicide, the homicide team that I worked on was relatively diverse. Maybe not so much when it comes to age, but when it comes to like background and considering the volume of homicide that we had, the success rate was pretty damn good, Tad.
Right. It makes a huge, it makes a huge difference because you just have these different people who know different things and understand, you know, different perspectives of particularly if you're a victim is a young female, which they often are, to only have older guys on it is like, am I going to really figure out what she might have done? Like, would she have gone
good
to
call,
a bar
alone? For sure.
Would she have met someone online? All of those things a younger, you know, female could say, well, yeah, that's totally normal for my age cohort. Or no, yeah, that's kind of crazy. Like most people my age wouldn't do that. That's a really valuable insight that you need to have. And I think that's actually one of the really good things about so many women are moving into the forensic field. It's become so popular, partially because of the popularity of true crime, but it does bring in a lot of perspectives that, you know, certainly didn't exist when I was kind of a junior prosecutor. It was starting to change a little bit, but it was still mostly guys who had been cops who said, oh, I like the forensic side. So they just kind of shifted over to that. It wasn't a specialty area for people who weren't already cops. And I know at my current police organization, we've hired civilian forensic techs, which is a really good thing. I don't think you have to be sworn.
No, it's actually, you know, we could probably talk a little bit about that like at a different time between you and I, but I have a certain interesting perspective on how being civilians have actually cost us as forensic practitioners in terms of things like respect. I'm sure that you can probably figure out where I'm going with that. But I also should probably say that that is not globally true. I have worked with detectives where there wasn't even a blink that happened because I was not a sworn law enforcement officer. But there is also a different population of people that said dumb crap to me, like, oh, if you're not sworn, you're not born and all that. And I mean, I love working with police officers and detectives.
No, and that's true. And I mean, I'm a civilian attorney in a police department. So I no one talks to me at all the entire day. They're like, we're seriously civilian attorney. I got nothing to say to you, buddy.
Are you basically like the equivalent of HR?
Oh, right, exactly. I heard you say on one of the podcasts about HR wenches. I was like, oh, that's actually kind of a funny phrase. I like that. I can't say that.
Did I say that?
I will be fired and I'm the one who's supposed to be enforcing all of that stuff. So I will not
say that.
I chuckled to myself.
I mean, our team represents law enforcement. So, you know, we have a very close relationship with them and, you know, it's that attorney-client confidentiality, that privilege.
Yep. Yeah. And that so, helps. Yeah. I mean, that I will say a lot of officers will say that to me. This is privilege, right? And I say, yes, it is. So they give you more. That's a good benefit to have by having that attorney-client relationship for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It is like HR. You know all the secrets.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
All the bitching happens in there.
Actually, I'm saving it all for my book, though, my tell-all when I retire.
Oh, geez. And you're not retiring anytime soon, are you?
No, March 28th, 2025. But who's counting? I
mean, who's counting? Wait, that's like 3 years.
It's not that far away.
That's super close. And what are you going to do after retirement?
Well, I actually would like to spend more time doing no-body stuff. Yeah. I really enjoy the consulting. You know, I don't charge for it. So if any of your listeners want to send a case my way, I just actually talked to someone who I think is going to send something.
Okay.
I don't charge for it because for the most part, police departments can't pay. And I only work with police departments. So if you're, you know, boyfriend is locked up for a no-body murder, he may be innocent, but I ain't helping. So
that's not your area.
Go to the Innocence Project.
No, and actually, I mean, to be serious for a minute, the Innocence Project is a great project.
Yes.
And I'm a firm believer in it. But it's just not, I work with, you know, police and prosecutors. And there certainly have been times when I've said to them, hey, you don't have it in this case. Like, this is not close. And frankly, I'm not even sure you have the right guy because you have like three viable suspects. So I do believe in that. But
well,
it's
good for you.
I feel like to have credibility with the law enforcement community, I have to stay very pure. And I've had family members call me and tell me about cases. I'm like, yeah, that kind of sounds like your son actually didn't do it.
Well,
but it just is not my vibe. And I do think to maintain credibility, I only, you know, and I don't work for families either. Families can't hire me or anything. I have to get the police file, as you know, because if you don't have what the police have, it's really hard to work a case. You know, it's like, well, you could read the newspaper clippings and, you know.
Okay. So in that capacity, then you would be considered like a trial consultant so that all of your work would be privileged.
Yes. Although for the most part, I work with the police. I occasionally work with the prosecutors in a big part of my role is the police will come to me and say, hey, we have a case, a nobody case that we think we can bring. Can you help us convince the prosecutor? And so I'll sit down with them as a team and say, this is a good case. And here's why.
Yeah,
I do that. I do a lot of that because they like the fact that I was a prosecutor. So I kind of speak
prosecutor talk to say, yeah, I think you can, mm-hmm. I think you can make this case, you know, and sometimes, like I said, I say to them, I don't think you have enough here. I think you need more.
Yeah.
You need to mm-hmm. do, I'm a big to-do list guy. And so I'll give people a to-do list and say, here's what I think you need to do before we can even go to the prosecutor.
That's super interesting.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Jinx, Shelly. We're both like, yeah, that's awesome.
I know, right? Six and nine, you owe me a Coke. That's what we do as kids.
Yeah. You know.
Or a glass of white wine.
I feel like this would be a really cool.
That ain't water, people. Yeah. You think I'm drinking water on this podcast?
You know, what you're saying about, like, post-career, I could see crime scene investigators really taking value off of, like, a webinar or even an in-person training on that. So maybe mull that over in your mind.
Yeah. Because, and I mean, I've never looked to make money off it. I made a very small amount off mm-hmm. the book. I generally get my expenses paid for. But unfortunately, my current job is super strict about outside employment. Yeah. And I did mm-hmm. think, maybe I should think about, you know, maybe teaching or doing something like that. But to me, I feel very passionately about these cases. And I think we've come to a good place where it used to be a lot of prosecutors would say, you don't have a body. We can't make this case. And I think we've gotten away from that. And to me, that's a good thing. And hopefully I've played a very small role in that, in convincing people, no, you can make a case. It's in all 50 states, Puerto Rico, DC, the Virgin Islands. They are cases being made every single day.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, of the 570 cases that I have found, more than half of those, probably 54-55%, have happened since the year 2000. So you're talking about half the nobody murder cases in the last 22 years. And I have cases going back to, like, the early, I think the first case is like 1819, which was like a bunch of dudes in a ship. They're like out sailing, like, hey, the captain sucks. Let's throw his ass overboard. And then they come back into port and was like, where's the captain? It's like, well, I don't know where the captain is.
I don't know. It's a mutiny. It's a good old fashioned mutiny.
And they're like on trial for it. And they get it's so funny when you look at the trials back then, the trial was like one day and the next day they were hanged. It was like, wow, he didn't fuck around back then.
Due process really did not, like.
Yeah, it's like, there's no appeal. You lost the trial. You're good.
There's no appeal. Yeah, there's
so are
no...
you talking about the list that you have? Is that the list of cases that you're referring
to? Yes, it's summaries of all the cases are in the book. But when I wrote the first edition of the book, it was 399. But now I'm up to about 570. Mm-hmm. But it's on my website, which is nobodymurdercases.com. Yep. There's a table of all the cases there. So someone can go.
Yeah, it's 133 pages.
Yeah, it's very long. I just did it on a Word document, which anyone who's like computer savvy is like, the fuck is that? A Word doc?
Why didn't you make Excel?
Have you heard of this thing called Excel? And I'm like, I don't do Excel. It's just totally do fine. A Word doc.
Yeah, don't you have like a law clerk or don't you guys have like,
I have don't my you daughter, lawyers have and then people? She like went off to college and I was like, okay, yeah, fine. Leave your dad. Whatever.
Well, I mean.
I'll volunteer.
Yeah, Shelly will help you.
Experience. I got you.
It probably can actually fairly easily be. And what's funny is, when my older daughter, Joanna, when she did the spreadsheet of the where the bodies, you know, were disposed of, she, of course, did an Excel spreadsheet. And I was like, okay, I'm totally embarrassed. My, you know, college-age daughter has just cranked out this wonderful spreadsheet. And what's funny now is for the second version of the book, my younger daughter, Sophie, who I have to mention, because if I mention the older one, you got to fucking mention the younger one. She's updating her sister's work for the second book. And that
the
will
scales
actually
scales of justice.
I know. And then they're, you know, because she's probably like, do I get a cut of the book? I'm like, yeah, no. But I am paying her for her work. I'm paying her.
That's nice of you. So it's funny that you keep mentioning this like small monetary like reward from the book, because when I was in grad school, my mentor authored a book and she was all excited when it came in, and I was standing there and I was dating somebody who was in my cohort for the grad program at the time. And he said to her, hey, how much money do you make every time you sell one of those books? And she's like, oh, you know, like nothing. And he goes, nothing? What the hell did you put in all that work for then? Because he was very like frank.
Yeah.
And she goes, prestige. And he goes, when the phone bill comes, write prestige on it and put it back in the mail and send it to AT&T? Heather, you have to make money off of all of that work.
Yeah, it's hard, let me tell you, because like you said, it's priced like a textbook, so it's very expensive. And you know, the good news is I probably make $10 off the sale of it. But I didn't do it for the money. Yeah. I mean, I did it because everyone kept saying, you ought to write a book. You ought to write a book about it. There's no book out there. And there's actually another book coming out by someone I've connected with about nobody murder cases that is not exactly like mine, but is similar, which is good. I'm sitting here. I have this book here, which is called Murders Without Bodies. It's about prosecutors prosecuting 4 or 5 nobody murder cases. There are some other books coming out. I actually have a Nobody Murder Hall of Fame, and it's for any prosecutor who's prosecuted more than one nobody, because I only prosecuted one.
Wow.
But there's probably about 13 or 14 prosecutors across the country who have prosecuted more than one, which to me is really impressive. And then there's about 2 or 3 who have prosecuted like 4 or 5 nobody murder cases, which to me is really, you know, impressive. I mean, I had 20 murder trials as a prosecutor and only one was a nobody. But when you think about, these people have had multiple ones, that's to me pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Are you consulting with them on their cases and such and helping them?
Yeah, so there's a prosecutor out of Michigan I've worked with before who's done a lot of cases. There was a very famous case out in New York that I've worked on. So I generally don't talk about them. That's kind of the agreement. As I say, once I work on the case, I'll never talk about it again, but
that's okay. That's kind of the nature of our show. Yeah,
you just don't. And I probably consulted on about 50 across the country now, and a couple internationally. Mostly, I stay in the United States, but so you know, 50 over the past 15 years. And if I had more time, I'd do more. I'd probably be more aggressive about doing more. So maybe when I retire.
Yeah. The nature of our show, Shelley and I share our experience through investigations, but we are always devoid of identifying details. So as you listen,
I noticed when you
to
said
the rest
that.
Of our show. Yeah. So like, for example, if like I am asking you about like this evidence question about like, oh, like what would you collect? And there was a case that came to mind that could illustrate that, then it would be more of a situation of you being like, oh, this girl went missing, kind of like how you did with the young lady that her neighbor swooped in and took her. Like, like that's preferential anyway. So you don't have to feel like you have to spill your guts here. However, if there is something that's like particularly interesting, like the story about the bra, like that's so intriguing and you didn't like exploit anybody to say it. So like, do you have any other like thing in the back of your pocket like that with like a nuanced detail that kind of was the trick that led to the case being able to be brought?
The one I would use is actually not a nobody case. It was a case, murder case I worked on in DC. So it was a woman who was murdered by her husband. And very horrific scene. And one of the few that I actually went on live, because in DC for a long time, we went to murder scenes because I knew we prosecuted by neighborhood. So I knew if a murder happened in DuPont Circle, it was mine, or, you know, Shaw, it was mine. So I went to this one because it was in Brookland, which is a neighborhood near Catholic University in DC. And it was a woman who had her throat cut so severely, when I walked in and saw her on the bed, I thought it was a smile because it was just like that gaping and it looked like a mouth. And I was like, oh, that ain't a smile, brother.
Yeah, that's not.
And the key piece of evidence in that scene was actually spotted by my boss, who was a very experienced prosecutor and supervisor, but he'd been a cop for 12 years. And most importantly, he'd been a smoker. And when he looked at that, we're flipping through the crime scene photos, and he sees the house had been ransacked like a burglary. So if you looked at this scene, you would say a burglar did this, and she was murdered upstairs, trail of blood running upstairs. And this ransacked chest of drawers, it's like the doors are open, the drawers are pulled open, shit is spilled everywhere. Mm-hmm. And on that ransacked chest of drawers, at the end of it was a cigarette perched on the end, and there was probably this much ash hanging off it. And it was very clear when my boss looked at it, Cliff Keenan, he said, the murderer smoked that cigarette because there is no way that that chest of drawers would be ransacked and a cigarette would be sitting there before that.
Just sitting there.
And he said, I was a smoker. It wasn't at the time. He said, what smokers do is they smoke and they put it at the end of the furniture and they make sure the ash is hanging off the edge so they don't burn the furniture. And he said, this guy ransacked this thing. He took his cigarette. He perched it there at the end and he left it there and he forgot about it. So our crime scene person, who is a great person, we call in D.C. the ones who do the murders are called mobile crime techs, because I know on one episode you all were talking about the different names. So the homicide ones were called mobile crime techs. She took a bunch of photos of it. She scooped it up. And of course, cigarettes, as we know, are great
evidence.
Tested it, and that was our murderer. And that was
I love it.
The main piece of evidence in the case, because the murderer was at the time the husband. They were separated and getting divorced, but he had left a bunch of DNA in the house, including blood in the house, which we also think was from that night. But if we'd only had the blood, he would have been able to say, well, yeah, I live there and I cut myself. Big deal.
But that cigarette,
every juror looked at it and said, yeah, that cigarette wouldn't have been there other than this burglary. Yep. And that was the key piece of evidence. So that became known as the cigarette case. But I always thought that was the biggest and best forensic case of my career because it was just so I to this day, I remember I was a very junior prosecutor. It was the first murder I worked from beginning to end. And I remember sitting in my boss's office and he's flipping through these photos with me. And he immediately says, that cigarette is the murderer's cigarette.
And
that is so awesome.
It is. And I'm really glad that there was such great crime scene photos that could have been seen. Connie Hickman, rest in peace.
She was great.
Oh,
I can use names of people who did good things. But yeah, Connie died a few years
ago.
Fantastic.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah. She was really
yeah,
great.
It's so funny because when you enter the field of forensics, you don't realize the emphasis that's placed on photography until you're like in role.
Yeah.
And then you're like, wow, this is a way bigger deal. And I probably would have taken some more photography classes in college had I known.
Yeah, it really is. It really. And what's funny is lots of times you see such crappy photography and you're like, did you learn how to take a photograph?
Luckily, the guy that trained me on my first crime scene job, his hobby was photography. So I had a very nice jump start. I didn't understand basic elements at first, but then, of course, they sent me to training. And next thing you know, I'm painting with light. So
I loved painting with
light. Everybody loves painting with light.
I'm so interested in, you know, in your life and your story and everything that's happening and everything that's, you know, that's going on. And, you know, so I'm just curious. You said that you're planning on retiring and then you're going to spend more time doing the nobody cases. Are you going to be traveling around doing them? Are you going to stay stationary? Like, what is your...
So I generally stay stationary. I get the police department to send the file to me. That's the kind of the main requirement is they got to send me the whole file, which means, of course, crime scene photos, the interviews, all of that. I find most departments are willing to do that. You know, they put on a flash drive and FedEx it to me, and then I'll go through everything. I mean, I just worked a case out of Montana. It probably took me a year to get through everything because it was a huge, huge file. But that's what I find to be the most useful. And then I'll kind of write up a report. Here's what I think. You know, do I think you have it? Do I think you don't? Here's what I think you should do. And then I'll sit and talk with them, with the investigative team, which typically includes the prosecutors, and say, here's what I think needs to be done on the case. And I think it'd be fun to do it as, you know, not necessarily a full time, but as kind of a, you know, I always say this is more than a hobby, less than a job. It's kind of in between that.
Yeah.
But I think it would be a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of CSIs that listen to the show. So if any of you guys have a nobody case and you want
a
consultant, reach out to Tad. Nobodycases.com.
Nobodycases.com. And then my
nobodycases.com.
Email is just tad.tobias@gmail.com. It's pretty easy. And you can't beat the price.
Okay.
I mean, you may get what you paid for, but you can't beat the price.
That is That is absolutely amazing. Is there anything else that you would like to, you know, talk to us about, tell us about,
Say I'm excited about the podcast because there hasn't been a lot of podcasts that focus on the forensic side. And I think that's really cool. And I think it's great that two women are doing it because it is a very popular career path and expanding career path.
Yes.
And as a father of two daughters who love true crime, they're the ones who kind of turned me into it. I think that's a great thing for people to see women in the law enforcement.
Aw.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate
it. Yeah. Well, thank you. And, you know, shout out to your daughters, both of them.
Yes.
Thank you everyone for listening to us and for, you know, joining us on this amazing podcast with our wonderful guest, Tad. Thank you so much for being with us. And, you know, if anyone else wants to learn a little bit more about true crime, definitely listen to us. If you have any questions, feel free to give us a shout out. Our email is hello@crimescenequeens.com. Make sure you check us out on all of our TikToks and Instagrams, or Insta, as Tad called it, because we do have those. Laura, what do we always say?
Well, if you're gonna die, do your local CSI a favor and die in an interesting way, and please leave your body.
Crime Scene Queens is a Q Code Media production. Executive producers David Henning and Steve Wilson. Produced by Ryan Countshouse. Edited by Nate Dufort. Theme song and music by Darren Johnson.